Welcome to the Send Parenting Podcast. I'm your neurodiverse host, Dr. Olivia Kessel. And more importantly, I'm mother to my wonderfully neurodivergent daughter, Alexandra, who really inspired this podcast. As a veteran in navigating the world of neurodiversity in a UK education system, I've uncovered a wealth of misinformation, alongside many answers and solutions that were never taught to me in medical school or in any of the parenting handbooks. Each week on this podcast, I will be bringing the experts to your ears to empower you on your parenting crusade. In this episode, I will be speaking with Tina McGillivray's, who will share with us her journey with her son, who has 48XXY syndrome with autism, PDA, which is pathological demand avoidance, Tourette's, and ADHD, which is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and how she steered her family from a point of complete breakdown to a much better place. This is an absolute must listen. Tina's honesty and openness and desire for other parents to know that they're not alone shines out. So welcome, Tina. It is such a pleasure to have you on the Send Parenting Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, you are so welcome. First, I have to thank you for being not only a listener of the podcast, but so supportive and sharing, you know, sharing the message with other parents, with your, you know, with your community that you've built up. It's, you know, I really appreciate it. So thank you, because
has made me cry. It's made me actually have to stop while I was walking the dogs because I've had such big emotions and actually gone, oh my God, there is other people going through this. Why is this not being talked about more? Honestly, every single one of your podcasts I've learned something from, I've resonated with, and I've felt, oh my gosh, yes, there is other people going through what I'm going through. And that is why I set up my page. So to have you doing it on a different form is just amazing.
Well, I think we really complement each other because we have the same kind of shared passion and vision and had the same feelings, which a lot of moms out there do, of being so alone and wanting to help others to not feel that way. You know, I do it through podcasting. You do it through, it's called the PDA Parent on Instagram, which stands for Pathological Demand Avoidance. And then you've got a newsletter too, which I've signed up for. So it's just wonderful to meet a kindred soul and spirit like yourself. And I'm really happy that you're going to share your story and your journey on the podcast today. I guess that's actually a really great place to start, is the journey with your son. And he has fragile 48XXYY syndrome. Is that correct?
He has a rare chromosome syndrome called 48XXYY. So he was diagnosed at age one when he wasn't meeting his milestones. He didn't walk till he was three. He had low speech. He was the most placid baby. He actually, when I looking back, I thought he was just a boy and I thought he was just slow, but he was actually just sitting there quite vacant. His muscle tone was really low. And he went into nursery. When I went back to work, so he was about 9 months, and they pulled me aside and said, we think that Innes is maybe not me, you know, lagging behind in some of his skills. And I was raging. How dare you? He's just a boy. And I'd had an older daughter, so I just thought it was because he was a boy. But we went to a paediatrician, and interestingly, the paediatrician, the first thing he did was look at his palm, and he said he's got a singular palm crease. So a lot of children with Down syndrome or chromosome syndrome have a singular palm crease. So I'm not a palm reader, but he took some bloods, and fast forward 3 weeks, I was sitting in the room when he said, your son has 48XXYY, which means he has double chromosomes in every cell of his body. I never worked with it before. I've never met anybody with it. Here's a leaflet. And we went home and went, oh. But Innes was still so placid. You could take him anywhere. I thought, this is no bother. And it wasn't until he went into school that he started to struggle more. And XXYY is kind of an umbrella diagnosis. So underneath the XXYY, you have a lot of autism, ADHD, Tourette's. And I knew that Innes was autistic. And I went into the school, and I actually asked for a referral to CAMHS because at that point we were struggling with quite challenging behaviour. But he was still quite little. He was maybe about 7 or 8, and CAMHS really... I went to the first meeting we went with CAMHS, Innes wouldn't come into the room. He said, I don't like the grey floor. The lady's sitting on a blue chair. I don't like the lady. He wouldn't come into the room. So I then had 4 really weird CAMHS things where she was kind of teaching me how to parent. But I was going along because I really wanted to tick all these boxes and I was determined to get him this autism diagnosis. And she wrote a really, really report, and you know what? When it came in, I actually burst out crying because it was full of parental blame. Mum is anxious. Mum is spending too much time on the internet. And this had gone out to all the professionals that work within us, and it really, really hurt me. I felt such shame. And she'd written in it quite a few times that we do not advise Innes to have an autism assessment.
To have that blame put, it's just, my heart goes out to you, you know?
Yeah. I always think as well, it's like, why do they think parents come into these rooms? We don't come into these rooms wanting to be difficult or wanting our kids to be challenging or saying we're having these struggles. We're not making it up just for the giggles, you know? So we went back, and then it was the headmistress at Innes' local primary. It was her last year. She'd been in the school for 40 years. This woman, she'd received awards. She had so much power and so much authority, and people respected her. And on her last, 6 months, she said, Tina, what do you need from me? And I said, listen, I really need you to get Innes diagnosed with autism. And she said, yeah, no bother. And she just sat. I felt like she was the only person in my world that I've ever met that said, I'm going to sit beside you. What do you need? And as soon as she walked into the room, everybody paid attention because she had this, authority behind her, and I didn't as his mum. So he was diagnosed with autism, then he was diagnosed with ADHD, and then he was diagnosed with Tourette's. So then we kind of moved forward a wee bit, and I've always spoken about this, and I think I chatted with you about it. Age 9, I don't know what happens at age 9, but the messages that I get and the emails I get mention age 9 all the time. I don't know if it's something to do with there's a gap between them, the child, and their peers. The peers start to go that way, and, the gap widens. And I also think that's the age that children get a wee bit more independent, so their social skills, when he was 5, there wasn't much difference between him and his peers, but by 9 it had. And I don't know if that's something to do with it or hormones, but age 9 is definitely something that I would like to learn more about.
Yeah, and, as I mentioned, there is actually a clinical reason, and actually with brain imaging studies, and when you see the children's brain of a neurodiverse child versus a neurotypical child, there's about a 30% lag. And so you have figured it out, Tina, exactly. At that point where it becomes more evident when other children's brains are maturing, I mean, even their gray matter is different, their myelination is different, and they're 30% lagging behind. And so you see your friends' children's, getting ready for school, packing their lunches, doing all this stuff, and your child is not there because actually that 9-year-old is more like a 6-year-old. And if you look at your 9-year-old and 6-year-old, you say, well, that's actually normal. So there is actually a reason why, from how their brains develop, that they are delayed. And I think it's a really important point. And for me as a parent as well, learning that was like, I could take a deep breath and go, okay, so that's why, and then to start looking at them instead of judging them. And you do judge, sadly, as a parent. Why can't they do that? Are they just being difficult? Do they just want to piss me off? But no, it's actually because they physically, physiologically cannot, they're not with their peers. So I think if education and parents need to shift around that concept as well, because you can't have the same, you wouldn't have the same expectations on a 6-year-old as you would a 6-year-old. So I think that's a great point to bring up. And yeah, my daughter was also 8 going on 9.
So 8 going on 9, he started to really struggle. But he was in mainstream primary, and his peers were really good with him. And we did manage to kind of bump through primary. Now, knowing what I know, I think that his peers were more able to co-regulate him and adapt their behaviour because they were mainstream peers. So I think that helped a lot. He was in a really small school. So, I mean, there was bumps, but it was when we moved into the SEN high school that the wheels came off the bus. And I think that was, I was so excited. Like, the SEN unit was amazing. I went in and they did so much, and I thought, he's going to love it here. He's going to love it here. This is brilliant. But he didn't. he didn't move as smoothly, and that's when he stopped being able to go to school. In the first year he kind of went part-time. The second year was horrendous. That was the really, really hard year, and that was the year that I learned about PDA and realized why we weren't fitting into everything else. So it must have been second year. So he was 13 when I realised he had the PDA profile. And it was the weirdest thing, because I was actually walking. Like, I didn't think I was going to have a life-changing moment in my wellies, but I was in my wellies, and it was absolutely torrential rain. And I heard two ladies talking about pathological demand avoidance or a persuasive drive for autonomy. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is it. Because in the SEN unit, it was set up. His other peers were all typical autism, so they loved a routine. They loved a structure. They loved the visual timetables. They loved the hierarchy of school. And they were thriving, and that really hurt, because I'm like, but my boy's autistic. Why is he not thriving? And when I spoke to the other mums, they were like, oh, yeah, they love it. I'm so happy. And I was like, is there something wrong with me? Is there something wrong with me? Why is my boy not coping in this environment? When I heard about PDA, I went on a deep dive research of the things that I thought that matched Innes with the PDA profile. One, that he hates visual timetables. He hates stickers. He hates rewards because they are a demand on his vulnerable nervous system. The other thing that was, Innes always had quite a good imagination. And typically autistic people don't have a vivid imagination, whereas Innes did. And often his special interests were on people. So that could be, he was really obsessed with Gordon Ramsay for a little while. He likes big people that break the rules, because Innes loves breaking rules, which is not typical autism. And he also used to get quite obsessed with maybe a peer in his school, but he would become so obsessive that he would sabotage the friendship, because although he had, sometimes you think kids with PDA have better social skills than a typical autistic person, but it's all really surface level. So he would become obsessed with one of his peers or somebody, and he would sabotage the friendship. So that was things that resonated with the PDA for me. And he also, he actually really liked trying new exciting things. And even if he met someone, like if he got a new teacher, that would really excite Innes. He would get that dopamine spike, and it would go really well for like a week, and then it would just go boom. And I could never understand why, because typically autistic people, when they get a new teacher, they'll do a social story and a visual board, and we'll have lots of introducing and stuff like that. Whereas Innes, he thrived with new people and new experiences, but then it just became a demand, and that's when we would get the challenge in behaviour.
So almost his environment was set up for a disaster, actually. It was the antithesis of what's worked for him that was working for the other parents. So did you see a slow deterioration then, or fast deterioration of how he was coping at school and then back at home?
His first teacher was quite a panicky woman. And I, one time he ran and she was going, oh my God, and I'm like, you're panicking, why are you panicking? So that was challenging, but he got to the point that, like getting Innes up in the morning is a demand. Me going into his bedroom and saying, I need you to get up and you need to go to school. This is all lots and lots of demands which activate his system. I always think of it like a jar of marbles. So Innes starts the day and he's got no marbles in his jar. Whereas if I am getting him to brush his teeth, get dressed, get in the car, get your school bag, I'm filling up his jar. So what happens is his jar just gets full and goes, and that's when he has a meltdown. So I always think of it like we're always going to activate him. You can't get by with not activating him, but it's how can we activate him less? Do you know? Can I put his shoes on? Can I brush his teeth? Can I get him dressed? Which is taking a marble out the jar, out the jar. So really all I do all day is spend time putting marbles in the jar.
Marbles out of his jar.
Hoping I don't get to that point that it triggers. Because I think what happens, and I've seen it a lot with Innes, like the last day he went out with his peers, I said to them, please let Innes get on the bus and choose where he wants to sit, because that gives him equality and autonomy, which is really important in PDA. But they were like, well, we can't because he's quite high risk. He has to sit beside his one-to-one. And we have to, you know, we'll put him in and we'll sit him beside the one-to-one. And I thought, this is just not going to work. But at the time I was like, right, okay. And I said, if Innes gets wet when you're out on a walk, you know, if he gets muddy, don't get him changed. Just leave him. He's only going to be on the bus for like 10 minutes. Just leave him. But they didn't, and they got him changed, and there was a massive meltdown. But what I felt happens is they just look at the last behaviour. Rather than looking at all these marbles that have gone into the jar, I always think they look for the last marble. What was the last thing that happened? Oh, we asked him to get on the bus. That must be the problem here, do you know? And it's just trying to explain to people that it's all the activations. You know, we have to look at everything that's just triggered his disabled nervous system again and again, light switch, light switch, light switch, light switch, till the light just goes boom, and that's when we have the challenging behaviour with Innes. But it did hurt a lot when the other typical, his peers with autism were coping so well within the environment. But it got to the stage that I was taking him to school, so I would get him into the car and he would sit, I mean, he's 6 foot at this point, he'd sit hunched up and he'd have his hood down. None of us could speak in the car. I couldn't speak, his sibling couldn't speak, we couldn't have the radio on. It was like I held my breath taking him to school. It was so stressful. And then I would get him into the school. At this time, he was only part-time, and he was going into a sensory room and just lying on his own in the dark. They couldn't get him to engage. And, you know, the school staff tried their hardest. They really did try their hardest, you know, but they didn't have the understanding of PDA and they didn't have the training of PDA. And if they did manage to get him out of the sensory room, he was having really challenging behaviours. He was throwing computers. He was being aggressive with peers, with staff. He tried to get through the ceiling tiles. And then I would just get a phone call and have to pick him up, and he would have had to be restrained in a CAMS hold. So I was going to pick him up, and it was weird because they'd have adults on the door. It must be part of the protocol. So it was like there'd be adults on the door, and then I would go in and he'd be curled up in a ball in the room with adults around him. And just one day he stood up and he's like, he was sheet white, and I got into the car and he's like, Mum, I'm a big boy, but I nearly cried. I'm not safe. You have to keep me safe. And that was the last day that Innes attended the education system.
Oh my God, that just must have broken your heart as a mother to hear your son say those words.
Yeah, and it had been a catalogue. He'd been getting restrained in CAMS hold for like quite a few months. They've got a thing called a PERS 100 form, which I don't know if that's just Scottish, but it's when there's been really high risk behaviour. And he was getting like 15 in a month, and he was only in the school for 3 hours. But the school were trying their best to give me some respite, you know?
Yeah.
But it got to the point that I was like, this isn't worth it, because him going in and lying in the sensory room for 3 hours, he was coming home and he was so challenging because he was so activated, you know?
Yeah. So it was worse with him going and coming back and getting there. How is he at home, and how's that journey been?
Yeah, when I first deregistered, it was the most scariest thing that I've probably ever did. I felt like I was taking this massive leap off a cliff and I didn't know which way I was going to fall, do you know? Yeah. On one hand, I was like, how am I going to cope with them 24/7 at home? I was worried about money because, like, you know, you can't financially work. I felt shame that we hadn't managed to survive in the education system. I kind of felt blamed by everybody else around me, like, why does Innes not go to school? And I felt fear about the future. And I had to process all those emotions. And I also spent a lot of time on Instagram going, oh, look at everybody else. They're doing great homeschooling. They've got glitter and they've got this. And I'm like, we've not even left the room, do you know? But, yeah, and I was also angry. I was angry at the education system that they couldn't manage.
Help you.
My boy. I do feel at the end, though, it became a bit of a cycle because, like, the inclusion team, so the SENCO team were saying to the school, well, you've got everything you need. You know, you're an SEN unit. He's got a robust EHCP. At one point, he had 3-1. and then the school were having these challenging behaviours and saying, what will we do? And when I was going to the school and saying, this is really traumatic, like, and they were saying, but we need a paper trail. We need a paper trail. And I was like, so really, we need to prove that he's failing. Do you know? We need to prove that this environment isn't working. And that's really traumatic for the school staff, for me, for my son, to prove to somebody in an office that this boy isn't, you know, we need a paper trail. It was like, let's see how much further he can fail before. But I, on the other hand, as a mother, I was so scared that something was going to happen that we couldn't come back from.
Yeah.
That's really hard to say it loud, but I was really worried that there was going to be an incident where he hurt someone or he hurt himself or he ran out into the community. And I just thought, like, everything can just change on a dime. And it was so challenging and high risk that I thought something like that would happen. And then I thought, what will happen?
Yeah, I mean, if just with my safeguarding hat on, listening to that we have to create a paper trail, you know, like, no. You have to keep the child safe. And as you say, the people around the child safe. And when you're 6 foot tall and you're being triggered continually, yeah, it's a ticking time bomb. I can understand your fear.
And then at one point I did go in and I said at the AHCP meetings, I can't do this anymore. I need you to send us to a residential school because we live in such a rural place. We only have one SEN unit. I said, I can't keep him safe. I can't keep my family safe. And I can't do this. And it was minuted and nobody would take that from me. Nobody would take that from me. And I knew other children in the area were away at residential school. At that point, I couldn't cope and I just got dismissed and I got minimised. And at one point, the like social work and education started bickering over the table about whose responsibility it was to look into residential. And I was like, I'm playing piggy in the middle here. This is just not on. So that has been a major part of why I started the page. I know there's a lot of professionals and specialists doing their utmost in a really broken system, but it's really vulnerable families that have been left in dangerous situations and also vulnerable families who are on their knees and reaching out for help. And when they reach out for help, they're just... I remember one... It must have been the Queen's birthday or the Queen's Jubilee, but the school was shut for that long weekend and Innes had a horrendous meltdown. He'd been restrained. I picked him up from school and the head of the SEN unit said, listen, I've phoned the head of social work. I've spoken to him personally. I'm going to get him to do a welfare check because I'm quite worried about your safety of your family. And so they'll be in touch and they'll do a welfare check. And, you know, I got home that day. And Innes was just upstairs. He was causing havoc. And I was so burnt out. I remember just staring at the wall. Like, I was just staring at the wall. I couldn't move. I couldn't do anything else. I just hit total burnout. And I remember the school trying to phone me to see if I was all right. And I just was like, it was just horrendous. But we went into that weekend. And I thought, oh, well, the social work's going to phone and see that we're okay. And you know, they never phoned. And that they never phoned. And I thought, do you know, like the headmistress from the SEN school's like, I don't phone them very often. Do you know, she said that was a major concern. And that's when I thought, oh, I feel quite scared now. I feel quite scared because I've been vulnerable and there's nobody's coming. Do you
nobody's
know?
Listening. Yeah, no one's well, listening.
Nobody's coming to save us. Do you know? That's yeah. kind of what I thought. And that just continued with social work. I felt dismissed. I felt ignored. I mean, they've got a duty of care to us and legislations, but they were breaking the law. Do you know? You know what? They have a care of duty for a disabled child, and they weren't doing that. Do you know? And I know it's because they're under the broken system, but I did feel very. It made me feel really scared, actually.
Because where do you turn to? You know?
And then the last DHCP meeting on the Friday, so it was on the Tuesday, and this was the last one I ever went to, and the social worker sent a message on quite late on the Friday, and I went, hey guys, we're just going to have to cancel Innocence DHCP meeting because unforeseen circumstances. And I was like, I was so stressed and I was so burnt out, and it just kept going round and round. And just the way they used hey guys in the email, it really triggered me. I was like, this just might not mean anything to you, but you know it was. But that was the day, the last CHCP meeting, I sat and I looked around the table. I thought, nobody's come to save us. Not one person around this table can help my family. And that's when I decided it was up to me.
Yeah. And that's a big responsibility, and to step away from that too, because you stepped away from it. You just said, that's enough. I've had enough. You know, you step, which is a very brave thing to do, but yeah. Especially when you're jumping into, you know,
the unknown. But it couldn't have been. Do you know, when I was jumping into the unknown, it was like, this can't get any worse than it already is. That's what I kept thinking. And I see a lot of, I was like, and this was 13, nearly, when I was 14. So I'd been in the arena getting my ass kicked for 14 years, do you know? and I had got to the point that I'd got my MSP, I'd written to all the heads of services, I had a lawyer at one point. I wasn't caring for my son because I was spending all day trying to fight for his rights. And then I thought, I can't do this anymore. Something's got to give. And it had to be the fight. The fight had to go. I was making myself very mentally unwell. And I did say that at the last meeting. I said, I'm really sorry, but you are all making me really mentally unwell. And when I'm mentally unwell, I can't care for my son.
Yeah.
So that was the last. And now, then I just went on a deep dive. I learned all about pathological demand avoidance. I learned all about your nervous system. I'm 47. I never knew I had a nervous system. Like, why are they not teaching this in school? Like, that would have saved me so much trauma in my whole life. And also, like, if they were teaching young children about their nervous system and neuroception and how the body reacts to different states, imagine how powerful that would be for the next generation's mental health.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And their self-esteem, to know, to not feel fear and shame when they have these big behaviours, because it's okay, we're human and this is totally natural part of our survival instinct, you know? So that was like a light bulb. And I really just dived into low demand parenting, and I became a mentor for my son rather than his parent, because the cultural traditional parenting didn't work for my son. Consequences, rewards, it just aggravated his vulnerable disabled nervous system.
Yeah. And it's kind of like a ripping up, or you know, learning a different way to parent, because it's not the way we think of parenting, where I'm right, you must follow what I tell you to do and you must be obedient, otherwise you know you're going to get punished or I'll reward you. It doesn't work. I don't think it works with neurodiverse children at all. Well, from all the mothers that I've spoken to.
But you know, not even the neurodiverse children. Like, I've altered my parenting for my other children. And I'm now.
That's a good point.
And it's just made our house so much calmer.
Yeah.
I'm not wondering about saying, you must listen to me. I am the adult. Like, I don't know what I'm doing. Do you know, as long as everybody's safe and happy. Do you know what? I don't care about anything apart from having my children growing up liking themselves in Innes's case, in a world that was telling him that he wasn't great, do you know? I just want him to like himself. I want him to have glittering self-esteem, and I want to have good well-being and good mental health. That is the most important things. Loads of people ask me, wow, what are you doing about Innes's education? What are you doing? And I'm like, right now, I'm just concentrating on self-esteem, mental health, and mental well-being, do you know? And I'm just following what he likes to do. That boy is an absolute whiz on the PC. Like, he could put me to shame. And his reading and writing isn't great, but he now has all the apps and technology that he can do anything.
I mean, really, how well does school prepare you for life? You know, knowing when the Battle of Hastings was and things like that. There's, you know, these children get so interested in things and learn things that are of interest to them. And that makes a huge difference. But I think it's that fear as a parent and probably from your, you know, the people that you interact with on Instagram, it's stepping away from education, you know? But in your case, you were kind of on a burning platform where you had to step away for, you know, you had to. It wasn't working.
What people say to me, like, I worry how I'll cope at home. But at that point, I was like, it can't get any worse.
Yeah. You know? So how has it been? Because it's been a year now, hasn't it, that you've been coping at home?
So, yeah, the last day of his school was the last day of the Easter holidays and the April holidays. And I have been through a roller coaster of emotions, to be fair. But we have a great relationship now. He doesn't leave the house that often. He doesn't need to leave the house just because society tells him he has to leave the house. He's quite happy in his world. And we have, and that's not going to be forever, but right now we're in a healing stage. And he came, my younger daughter was having a bit of a tantrum about a horse riding helmet. And he actually came out of his room the other day, and he's this big 6 foot giant. And he went, "Don't talk to mum like that. She doesn't deserve that." And he just came and gave me this big bear hug. And he, like, I'm so wee on him. My head was here. And he's like, "I love you, mum." And he does that all the time. He shouts out his room, "I love you, mum." And this is the boy that was so, so challenging and violent and aggressive. And when people say to me, "How did you get him back?" I just started scribbling outside the lines of everything that I've ever been taught about parenting, leaning into nervous system regulation, co-regulation, and not sweating the small stuff. I kind of flow now. Like, I go into his room and he'll call me a name, like, I don't know, big old witch. And he's just looking to level up. Am I safe? Am I safe? And I go, "I'm fine, butthead." You know, and then he laughs and I laugh. Whereas a year ago, I'd be like, "Don't you dare call me that. How dare you call me that? I'm going to take your PlayStation 4 off you for a whole week." And do you know, he's turning into a gentle, loving man. And it's because he feels safe. And I just want him to feel safe. Because at home before, when he was going into the school, he was coming home and he was so dysregulated that the behaviours at home were really, I didn't feel safe in my own house quite a few times. He ran away once and he tried to jump off the cliff at the back of the house and was hitting his head with stones. And it was really scary time. Being in the house, I didn't feel safe. And he was having really dark thoughts. And he was so dysregulated in his nervous system that he was actually disassociating. He was losing touch with reality. Which was really, really frightening. So when I think back to that boy just over a year ago, I just can't believe the change in him. And it's been through learning about pathological demand avoidance and as a nervous system disability and needing a total different way of parenting and just being in society. Societal norms and everything are just never gonna work for us.
Yeah. I'm almost speechless because what a journey to go on. And, you know, well done you as a mom to just, you know, you are a fighter. I know you've told me that you're not a fighter, but I think you are a fighter and you still are a fighter and you're fighting for what's so important, which is your son's mental health and well-being and your daughter's, and you're finding a way that works and look, flourishing, you know, and I'm sure your family's flourishing now too, as well. Not always, because I know that that's
it's just but I don't feel scared in my own house. Yeah. Which I did for a long time. I've not felt scared. And to be fair, I was saying that the other day. I don't think Ennis has had like one of those huge meltdowns when I've been really scared for the people in the house, him and myself. It must be about 6 months. I mean, sometimes he gets dysregulated, but I know he's getting dysregulated and I know he's getting activated. So I'm like, right, marbles. Where are the marbles? What's happening with the marbles?
What can I take out of the jar?
But what's happening? But because when it was really dark, that going back to that, I had reached out again to my GP and I said, I'm not coping. Like, I actually said to her, she said, are you having thoughts, like suicidal thoughts? And I said, I have actually thought about driving into a tree quite a few times. When I'm driving, I have this, I could just drive into a tree. And I said, do you know what though? I would have to have Ennis with me. Because if I'm going, I have to take Ennis with me. That's how much I was in trauma. And they were like, well, what we'll do is we'll give you a wee call back next week and see how you go.
Oh, my. You are kidding me.
No, it was just.
You've been so let down by every single
thing. Well, everybody says if you're not okay, reach out. If you don't feel okay, please reach out. And when you reach out and say, I'm not okay, everybody's like.
And I'm going to drive me and my son into a tree. I'll call you back next week.
And then they're like, I think you just need some respite. And I was like, because we waited on, and this got respite, overnight respite. Then when he was 9, we got allocated, I think it was 10 nights a year. And to this day, at 14, he's still never had a night. He's still never had a night. And they've actually just shut the respite centre now, so it doesn't even exist. But that's what we...
How did you get yourself? I mean, that's a pretty dark place to be. And you know, how did you keep going with no help? I mean, did anyone support you, or did you've just done
I
this
think
yourself?
It was that realization that nobody else was coming to help me. I think I'd been looking about for somebody to come in and save the day, and yeah. I think I realized that nobody else was wasn't going to save us. And learning about PDA and the nervous system, honestly, like that just changed my whole mental health. Do you know? Yeah. That's why we're
giving you back some funnily enough, I don't use the word control because it is actually giving up control, but it gave you a way forward.
Like this is why this is happening. This is why this is happening, you know? And I used to get so frustrated because the people who were in jobs who are meant to help me weren't helping me. And that would make me really angry and frustrated. And I'd get on the email and I would, and I'd be on the phone, I'd be chasing people. And then when I kind of said, right, I'm putting these boundaries up. I don't want anybody to help me just now. It was great. I was like, now I've got time to just heal and heal through the trauma and heal through the burnout. And
because there's trauma to you, there's trauma to your son, there's trauma to the family. Mm-hmm. There's a lot to heal from there.
Yeah, and definitely. We just slowed down, and you know, a lot of people like talk about, oh, I'm just starting low demand parenting, and I always say, don't start low demand parenting until you understand why lowering the demands work. Do you know? Like yeah. I'm a mum. I never thought that I would have to learn a wee bit about neuroscience. Do you know? I didn't think that when I had my babies. And I didn't think I'd have to learn about the frontal cortex and stuff like that. But I did. I had to. And a lot of people are like, oh, how did you have time? Because my partner works away. I'm on my own. He comes home at the weekend. I work at the weekend. So I'm on my own. I'm a single mom during the week. And do you know what? I just thought, I need to do this to save us. So I was listening to podcasts. I really found Robin Goble really helpful. She explained the neuroscience in quite a simple way. So I was listening to podcasts like yours as well. I was reading books when I was in the bath. When I was cooking the dinner, I put a YouTube on with Stephen Porges, The Polyvagal Theory, or Debs Dana, and I was just getting wee glimmers, wee snippets of information all the time, learning from other PDA accounts on Instagram, and just that's how I got it. So when people say, oh, I don't know how you had the time, I was just utilising the time that I had, you know, putting headphones on when I was folding the laundry,
You'd also, you'd stopped all the other stuff. You know, you'd stopped the battling with the school. You stopped the battling with the social services. You stopped trying to get help, you know,
and you turned it inwards. Like really, really big emails to people. And it's so funny because I remember the Senko team saying, we're going to send in this lady and she's an assessor and she's going to write this report on your son. And it's going to be, you know, this is going to be. And see, when I read the report, I was like, I cannot see my son in that at all. It was just so fluffy and generic. And I was like, so I then counteracted and wrote a massive report on my son, which I don't even know if anybody read it. I did. I sent it out to everybody and said, this is my son. That report's not my son. And that you know, that was like, again, like I'm a mom and I was acting like a PA and everything, you know, to everybody. And then, I don't know, we reached out to CAMHS again. I remember when I was having the really, really dark thoughts, I said, I really need some help from, like, the mental health. I'm actually quite scared in my house and I'm scared that something's going to happen. Oh, my gosh, she came out and she met us outside because it was just after COVID and it was the most weirdest thing I've ever been through in my life. She started, I don't even know, but I did receive a report a few weeks later. And she said that she couldn't work with Innes because he's not ready or able to talk about his problems. And his problems warrant a direct behaviour type of approach in his real environment, and because treatment for CAMHS does not tend to be effective or generalised towards a person's real life.
Wow, pretty damning of their own service.
So they discharged him.
You know, we can laugh because there's a gallows humor in this, isn't there? There really is.
Yeah. But now looking into it, that CAMHS team didn't have a learning disability team. That's what's happening. Do you know? They're not, the CAMHS is not set up to deal with people with neurodiversity. Which, looking like as a child and adolescent mental health service, I think that a high proportion of the people that get referred to them are neurodivergent, do you know?
I mean, and everyone wants to go to them to get diagnosed as being neurodivergent. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Wow. And yet, oh gosh, it's like peeling an onion with CAMHS. You just keep getting more and more layers of just wow.
Yeah, and see, when I speak to some of the other mums, really dangerous, leaving families and really, and like just having a letter that says, we're discharging you because your son's not ready. And you know, like, that's really, really damaging, and really that whole service needs rebooted. And the other thing about the social work, because I go on about them a lot, is most social work teams don't have a disability team. They don't have a disability team. So the social worker that you're getting through your door is trained in child protection.
Yeah, and that's what they're looking for. Yeah.
They look through the lens of child protection, and that is... That's quite scary for a child who's a family whose child is having quite challenging behaviours, because they look through the lens of the, because when I went to the ACHP meeting and social work had totally ignored me, they'd acknowledged I was in crisis just before summer and said, we're going to support you 2-3 days a week, don't you worry. And I left the meeting, thought, oh, this is going to be great. Never heard from them all summer. So I went back into the meeting and I can't believe the social worker said something like, maybe your son's swearing because of what he's watching on YouTube. And I was like, I actually stormed out the meeting and I went and cried in the toilet. And I thought, I've not cried in the school toilet since I was like maybe 13. I'm 47. And you know, I've never cried in a meeting at anything that I've ever been to, even when I had like a corporate job in my 20s. I never cried. People shouldn't be crying in meetings.
No, they shouldn't.
And then I mean, this boy's got a diagnosis of autism and ADHD and Tourette's, and it's, you know,
it's that
all she had to bring to the table. And then when I went back in to get my jacket, I said, I'm leaving because that. And she said, well, you know, I've got a duty of care to bring these things up. So yeah, that's what I walked out of when I said I'm putting my boundaries up. Do you know, I wasn't getting any help anyway, I was just being tied in knots by a broken system. Like, and I was caught in the tangles of a system and structure and services that are absolutely on their knees. And I just thought, I don't want to do this anymore.
And have you just been able to sever all ties with them?
Yeah, the Senko lady phones me once every 6 months, but I think they were probably quite glad to get rid of me. If I pushed again, I know that it would hurt their purse strings because he couldn't go to the SEN unit here, so he would have to go to residential, which would cost the local authority a lot of money. So I think they're just like, just nod and agree, you know, because that's quite... That's what it was about. Purse strings was really, you know, at the end of the day.
And honestly, everything you've told me and, you know, that you've learned yourself and that I know myself, would a residential placement be the right place for him?
No,
you know, probably not.
I didn't understand about PDA then. Yeah. I hadn't had that light bulb moment with the PDA. So at that point, I thought I was
safe. You would be safe there, it's more about safety, wasn't it?
And yeah. Safe for him and to give his siblings back a life. And at that point, I was thinking it would give me back a bit of a life, do you know? Because I was so burnt out. And at that point, I was like, yeah, I can't keep him at home. It's not safe. But even when I said that, it didn't transpire. But looking back, no, it wouldn't have worked at all. It wouldn't have worked at all because the problem wasn't the education, it was his persuasive drive for autonomy at all times, you know, and his PDA.
Well, he's lucky to have a mum like you is all I have to say. You know, you've succeeded where, you know, you've gotten to the other side, which is really impressive. And I really appreciate you sharing your story today because other parents that are going through this, and I know all of your followers too, get such mm-hmm. hope and inspiration from you, you know, because you've done things differently. You've tried as hard as you can within the system. You really have fought it and tried, and then you've taken it away and you've done what's best for your family and what's best for your son. And I love the story of, you know, him saying, I love you, and telling your younger, you know, daughter to be, you know, be nice to mom, you know, what a difference. I mean, that's chalk and cheese from someone who's, you know, trying to jump off a cliff and banging rocks into their head. So, you know, I just have to take my hat off.
We have such lovely conversations and moments now. But do you know what? We just laugh. Like, humor is such a de-escalator for everything. I wish I'd used humor more. It was taking off that parental mask about, I am in control, I am the authority, you must do as I say. It was taking off that mask and just saying, we're all humans in here. Let's just all be human together. And I have big emotions and sometimes I lose it and I have a mum huff. And do you know what? I'll go in and say, that was mum when she was angry.
It was funny this weekend, my daughter didn't want to eat her food and we had someone from outside of the family sitting there and you can just, you know, tell they're like, you know, she's not eating her vegetables. She's not eating her this. And I looked at her and, you know, she's scowling at the table and I went and put on Golden Oldies and then I started singing Summer Doo-Doo and being a total ass, you know what I mean? Just, you know, and she's going like this. And then she just couldn't help herself, you know, and then I'm like, I bet I can eat my beans faster than you can eat your beans. Not only did she eat her beans, she went and helped herself to more beans so that she could keep competing with the bean eating competition. And the person that was with me at the table was just looking at me. He's like, you know, I've got to learn some of your psychology because that's not how it was when I was raised, but that, you know, and what a better way, you know what I mean? And it's from listening to moms like you, it's from listening to people on the podcast. I wouldn't have known that, you know, my mother would have probably, you know, smacked me, sent me to my room, and I wouldn't have had any food.
It's okay to like parent differently. Like, who made up the rules in society? And like, who made up these cultural conditioning rules? Like,
men about 150, 200 years ago who never parented, you know, they make these, and it keeps getting rehashed as new parenting advice. Leave your child alone crying in their bedroom, you know?
And do you know what? We're all humans. And like the education system is just bringing these, everybody's got to conform. It's so sad that society says, if you don't conform, then you're not accepted. I want my children to be thinkers. Like, that's what we need. We need these creative children because look at the state of the world. Look at the state, look at all the wars and the environment and like everything that's so broken. We need these, we do not want these children to conform. We want these children to say why, do you know?
I so agree.
It's these creative brains. You know, these neurodiverse children that are going through, if they're nurtured just now, they have got different thinking patterns to change everything that we have broken in mainstream society, do you know?
I totally agree with you. And you know what? I think they will. And I think that, you know, it gives us hope, and our children are hope, and they are inspiring, and they will go on to hopefully change the world and look after us in our old dotage when we, when we need them. Now, as we wrap this up, Tina, I'd love if you could give three tips that you could give to parents to take away. And I know that's hard with everything we've discussed, but if you're thinking of talking to a mom like you, what three top tips would you give them?
I think it's to realize that your voice is the most important in any room. I never knew that. Like, I didn't know that my parental voice was so powerful. And the voice of my son, I wasn't listening to me and my son for so many years. I was listening to everybody else because I thought they knew what they were doing. Do you know?
Yeah.
Really wish
trusting your gut. Yeah.
I really wish I'd listened to my, like, when my son stood up that day and says, "You need to keep me safe." That was the moment. Like, why had I not been listening to him before, with all his challenging and behaviors that were so scary? That was him telling me that he didn't feel safe, and I wasn't listening. The other thing I would also say is to know your worth. Don't let these discharge CAMHS letters or people saying, "No, we're not putting your child for an autism assessment." Know your worth, do you know? When these letters come through, there's thousands of us getting them in the UK. It's not just you, do you know? Because when I got the letter, "Mum is anxious" or "Mum's spending too much time on the internet," that crushed me. And now I know from speaking to other parents on my page that I am not alone in that. And the other thing, I am getting so many messages just now of people who are suddenly looking at their child through the lens of a nervous system and activations and accommodating. And they're like, "This is like putting on a new pair of glasses." Like, I got a message this morning and this lady's like, "I just got him to school." And like, it was amazing. She said, "Because I just dropped everything that I didn't have to do, do you know?" And I get loads of messages like that. I've been speaking to a lady who's actually in London just now, and she's like, she keeps messaging me. She's like, "Oh my God." She said, "Honestly, it's like, it's been really foggy and somebody's just lifted the," and it is understanding that it's a nervous system disability and that our child's nervous systems, and they're going into fight or flight and fawn and freeze, just, it's happening all the time, do you know? And I think I fawned. I was a fawner. If I'm looking at my nervous system, fawning is where you just sit there and hope that the lion doesn't kill you. I fawned for years. Like, I was a fawner. I was a people pleaser. And I think I was a people pleaser because I didn't want to be judged as a bad mum. Because when your kid is challenging or they are sort of not conforming, you don't want to be judged as a bad mum, so you become a really bad people. You become like really people pleasing, much more so. Parents with neurodivergent and disabled children become much bigger people pleasers because we're so worried that somebody is going to judge us, because they do in these letters that we get.
Yeah, and even being out in public, you know what I mean? I talk to mums as well. You know, you're out in public and then, you know, people, and then you start to become more of that kind of, you're pleasing them at the detriment to your child. You know, you become like, "No, don't do that. Don't do that." And, you know, you know, and then it's just getting worse over here, and they're judging you more, and you're trying to
dare you speak to me like that? How dare you not listening to me? You're embarrassing me. And then the poor child is feeling all this blame and shame, and it's crushing down on them. And then you're wondering why you get home and they explode.
And you don't even know who that person was, you know, that you're trying to please over there. You know, it's
I don't people please anyone. Like, the only people that I'm worried about pleasing are the people in this, my house, do you know? And we just have such a laugh these days. It's so much easier. It's just like taking that step back from what society says we should be and mainstream, this is what we do and this is how we do it, and we leave school and we go to an Ivy League college and then we get a good job and then we hustle and we bustle, and I'm like, "No, I don't want that."
I think, and as hard as your journey has been, and as hard as everything you've described to us, it's also given you that superpower to scribble outside of the lines.
I had to go through the journey. I couldn't have just got here. Like, see that really dark time. I had to go through that. I had to go through that to get to the other side. There was, if I hadn't had Innes with him having the PDA and all the neurodiversity, I would have been a total different person. I would have been just cruising on the mainstream society, not questioning and not asking anything and not realising. And I'm so glad, like, what we went through was so hard, but I'm so glad that, I know everybody says it, but he kind of changed my journey, and he might have changed my journey to save me and save him, do you know?
Yeah, I totally, you speak to my heart. I agree. And I think you'll speak to a lot of listeners too, because it's, and I hate anyone saying it's a gift or they're special or whatever, because I
I'm not a superhero. My cape is broken. I've got holes in my tights. I'm not a superhero, but it just put a different lens on it, didn't it?
Yeah. And it is kind of like that peeling back. And then you're like looking at the world. It's like, what? I didn't even, whoa, you know,
oh, it's really broken. It's really broken. I don't want to play. I don't like it. That's what I say. I just like, oh, this is all so broken. And I always thought, I was saying this the other day, I always thought that people in like above jobs were God. Like, I remember when I was younger, I thought the doctor was God. Like,
I mean, I am a doctor, and you know, it was, I had to actually become disillusioned of that too. I remember when I trained in medical school in Ireland, they would say to me, they would go, oh Jesus, you know, the patient doesn't need to know what's wrong with them. It'll only bother them. We all know what's wrong with them. And I was like, really? That doesn't sound right to me.
And you know, it was, I spoke about this with a lot of the people on my page, like the sub post office scandal.
Oh yeah.
Like, that resonated with so many of us in this community, because these people put their trust in a system and the British justice system, and they were being disbelieved and minimised, and no, it's just you, nobody else is having that. I resonated so much with that, do you know, as a parent, so, a child, and the system, that, because I thought that these people on the SENCO team and the heads of social work and it, they knew what they were doing. These people were gods, and then I realised, no, they don't. They're as much in the broken system as I am. And honestly, I think that a lot of them are in the blame and shame part of the nervous system. So they're sitting in total fight or flight because they know they're in a broken system.
Yeah. Well, it has been an absolute pleasure, Tina, to have you on the show. I've really enjoyed our discussion. And thank you.
Thank you for listening, Send Parenting Tribe. Please look in the show notes for book recommendations on PDA and links to Tina's newsletter. Also, if you're listening in Spotify, please rate the podcast by clicking the About button and rating us out of 5 stars. If you're listening in Apple Podcasts, click on the link to the show and then scroll down to the bottom and you can rate us there. From my data, it looks like those are the two most popular platforms, so I won't bore you with details of other platforms, but your ratings really matter. The more people that I can get to rate the show, the more the show will be shown to other parents. And just like Tina in today's podcast, my goal is to make this information available to as many moms and dads out there so that they don't feel alone with their struggles and they know they're part of a community. Thank you, and wishing you and your family a happy week ahead.